History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I say it again, you've been had, you've been took, you've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what he does.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Same brothers from a long time ago. We was talking about television and doing it on the radio. What we did was to help our generation realize they got to get out there and get busy because it wasn't going to be televised. We got respect for young rappers and the way they're freewaying. But if you're going to be teaching folks things, be sure you know what you're saying. Older folks in our neighborhood got plenty of know-how. Remember, if it wasn't for them, you wouldn't be out there now. And I ain't coming at you with no disrespect. All I'm saying is that you damn well got to be correct. Because if you're going to be speaking for a whole generation, and you know enough to try and handle their education, be sure you know the real deal about past situations and ain't just repeating what you heard on a local TV station. Sometimes they tell lies and put them in a truthful disguise. But the truth is, that's why we said it wouldn't be televised. They don't know what to say to our young folks, but they know that you do. If they really knew the truth, why would they tell you? The first sign is peace. Tell all them gun-toting young brothers that the man is glad to see us out there killing one another. We raised too much hell when they were shooting us down, so they started poisoning our mind and trying to jerk us all around. And then they tell us they got to come in and control our situation. They want half of us on dope and the other half in incarceration. If the ones they want dead ain't killed by what they instigated, they can put some dope on the brother's body and claim it was drug-related. Tell them drug-related means there don't need to be no investigation, or at least that's the way they're gonna play it on the local TV station. All your 9mm brothers, give them something to think about. Tell them you heard that this is the new word. They got to work that stuff out. But somehow they feel in the wrong way with a gun in their hands. They feeling real independent, but they just pulling contracts with a man. The average guy will tell you it's hopeless out there on the avenue, but if they really knew the truth, why would they tell you? And if they look at you like you're insane and they start calling you scarecrow and say you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you've suddenly gone lame, or that white folks have finally co-opted your game, or worse yet, implying that you don't really know, that's the same thing they said about us a long time ago. Young rappers, one more suggestion before I get out of your way. But I appreciate the respect you give me and what you got to say. I'm saying protect your community and spread that respect around. Tell brothers and sisters they got to calm that bullshit down. Because we're terrorizing our old folks and we brought fear into our homes. And they ain't got to hang out with the senior citizens. Just tell them, damn it, leave the old folks alone. And we know who's ripping off the neighborhood. Tell them that BS has got to stop. Tell them you're sorry they can't handle it out there, but they got to take the crime off the block. And if they look at you like they think you're insane, or start calling you scarecrow thinking you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that white folks have suddenly co-opted your game, or worse yet, saying that you really don't know, that's the same thing they said about me a long time ago. And if they tell folks that you finally lost your nerve, that's the same thing they said about us when we said Johannesburg. But I think you young folks need to know that things don't go both ways. You can't talk respect on every other song or just every other day. What I'm speaking on now is the raps about the women folks. On one song, she's your African queen, and on the next one, she's a joke. And you ain't said no words that I haven't heard, but that ain't no compliment. It only insults 8 people out of 10 and questions your intelligence. 4-letter words or 4-syllable words won't make you a poet. It will only magnify how shallow you are and let everybody know it. And if they look at you like they think you're insane, or they call you scarecrow thinking you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that the white folks have finally co-opted your game, or you really don't know, they said that about me a long time ago. If they finally start telling people that you lost your nerve, that's what they said about Johannesburg. You ain't insane, you have got a brain, you haven't gone lame, you have got your game. Remember, keep the nerve, keep the nerve, keep the nerve, keep the nerve.
Hotep, and greetings to all of you, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers, and I am here with you every Tuesday evening.
This call is being recorded.
From 8 to 10 p.m. So we thank all of you, our listening audience, for joining and being with us each Tuesday evening. And as usual, we hope we can energize and sort of promote folk to take action, look at our world, and see what we need to be done. Hopefully you had a wonderful day today. It was a very sunshiny day here in Georgia. Temperature was in the lower areas of the 30s, but nevertheless, it was very sunshiny, quiet, peaceful. The Black Reality Think Tank is broadcast live here at our studio in Lithonia, Georgia, through the internet platform of the timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network system. We broadcast, as I said to you earlier, live every Tuesday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Our program is sponsored by the Motherland Media Network, and it is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. We sincerely thank you, again, our audience, and all of those who participate and help with the planning and the production of the Black Reality Think Tank. The Black Reality Think Tank is an information sharing and discussion-oriented program. It is designed to understand the past, dissect the present, and support implementing a meaningful future. The purpose of the Black Reality Think Tank primarily is a historical research program. It is designed to teach, to inform, and empower African-American community leaders. Through our radio program and our social media platform, we present what we feel are well-researched facts and evidential proof that will assist the community in constructing meaningful agendas and setting realistic goals and objectives. We believe that all of history is a current event, and we promote the idea that you will never know where you're going unless you understand from which you came. We have a call-in format for our program this evening, and we really would love to have you call us in, and let's talk about and make your comments or ask questions about some of the things that we're going to discuss this evening. Our calling number is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. And we would love to have you call us and give us your thoughts and your opinion as we move forward in the discussion that we have planned for this evening. We had a very dynamic discussion on last week. We had a young filmmaker from Jamaica came on and talked about an initiative that's going on in search of reparations. And the idea was to let her talk about the filming of that. It's what the focus was and its purpose. It's an initiative that's been going on in Jamaica for a while, started by the Rastafarians, and it has been moving forward. And there are some reports on it since the broadcast. And we're going to talk about what that exactly is, and we're going to kind of dissect it. As I've indicated, that this is a think tank kind of format, and so what we do is we look at ideas, we try to find research and truth and be able to assess what that means and understand it and move it back and forward so that the community can have a clear vision of what they see and hear. Sometimes a lot of the news and the reporting of news is very deceptive, and a lot of times what we see is not what we get. And so here at the Black Reality Think Tank, we want to be able to dissect an idea and look at all of the factors, take it at what we call the eclectic viewpoint. And at that way, we can make, you know, sort of firm decisions about how things are done. So Ms. Marfan Dequa, who's from Jamaica, she was with us last week, and she definitely gave us a wonderful dynamic. The film was available for viewing. She left that up for a couple of days, and hopefully some of you got to see it and really take a look at it. So with that, I am going to move on. As always in our production here, we like to do what we call the ancestral profile. We take a look at our ancestors and whose shoulders we stand on. We operate in the spirit of the great Fannie Lou Hamer, who told us many years ago that we should always praise the bridges that brought us over. We should always praise the bridges that brought us over. And so we do that here. And we take a look at those who have paved the way for us and who we now are following in their path. Tonight, I want to take a look at a gentleman, a brother, by the name of Arthur George Gaston. Arthur George Gaston, better known as A.G. Gaston. Mr. Gaston was a very wealthy African-American businessman and civil rights activist. He was born on July the 4th, 1892, in Demopolis, Alabama. He was born to Tom and Rosa McDonald Gaston. He was raised by his former enslaved grandparents, Joseph and Idella Gaston. In 1905, Arthur Gaston moved to Birmingham, where he attended the Tuggle Institute for Black Children. In 1910, he joined the Army, and during World War I, he served overseas in France. After his honorable discharge from the military, Mr. Gaston worked for the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company in Fairfield, Alabama. And while employed at that mine, Gaston became an entrepreneur. He was selling meals and affordable burial insurance to the black community in that area. In the late 1930s, he opened an insurance company and a funeral home across from Kelly Ingram Park in downtown Birmingham. As his insurance business grew, he diversified his financial services by opening the state's only black-owned savings and loan bank in the early 1950s. His business also sponsored black cultural events and even formed a black quartet that performed on the nation's first African-American radio program. In 1954, Gaston opened A.G. Gaston Motel near his other businesses to welcome black visitors who were turned away from hotels that practiced Jim Crow segregation. Before the close of the decade, he employed the largest number of African-Americans in the state, and he had become one of the wealthiest African-Americans in the United States. During the early years of the modern civil rights movement, Mr. Gaston effectively was able to maneuver quietly behind the scenes to support civil rights activists. He offered to donate money to the legal team of Arthuring Lucy, who was an African-American who in 1955 had filed a lawsuit to integrate the graduate school of the University of Alabama. He also gave financial assistance to Tuskegee activists forced out of their homes because they challenged the voting demonstrations, discriminations. In 1956, when Birmingham civil rights activist Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth founded the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights, the organization held its initial meeting at the Gaston's downtown office. Gaston also allowed activists to lodge at his hotel and meet there to plan campaigns. During the 1963 Birmingham demonstrations at Kelly Ingram Park, Gaston used his financial resources to bail out of jail Martin Luther King Jr. and other incarcerated activists. A.G. Gaston died at the age of 103 on January the 19th, 1996. He had left behind the Booker T. Washington Insurance Company, the A.G. Gaston Construction Company, the A.G. Gaston Boys and Girls Club, and the CFS Bank Shares Incorporated, the nation's second largest black-owned bank, A.G. Gaston. If you are interested in reading more about Mr. Gaston, there's a book written by him, by Gaston himself, called Green Power, The Successful Way of A.G. Gaston. Again, it's called Green Power, The Successful Way of A.G. Gaston. It's a Southern University Press publication. It was copyrighted in 1968. And then there's another book by Carol Jenkins and Elizabeth Garner Hines called The Black Titan, A.G. Gaston and the Making of a Black American Millionaire. And this was published by One World Ballantine Books in 2003. A.G. Gaston. Okay, thank you so much. A very powerful brother. There's a lot more history to A.G. Gaston as well. Very interesting, his interaction and relationship with all of the civil rights folks and some of the things that he was doing. Well, my brothers and sisters, as you know, we got a lot going on, as we always have been here. A lot of things are happening right around us every day as we speak. A lot of things are making changes to our life. I haven't heard yet the outcome of that election in Alabama. I'm sorry, in Mississippi. It's probably a little too early to detect. It's 8:17 here, which is Eastern time, and I think Mississippi might be on Central time. So maybe the polls are just closing there. As you know, Mike Epsi is running up against a white supremacist female who openly has stressed her connections to the Confederacy and to the Ku Klux Klan and made some very horrible remarks about lynchings. And she is running as a candidate. Obviously, the sitting president has endorsed her. She is a Republican. But Mike Epsi is your challenger, Democrat, Mississippi. He has a history. Bill Clinton appointed him. I think it was he was the Secretary of Agriculture at the time. And he was a big active part of the early years of the Clinton administration, and eventually he had to be, I think he was dismissed or had to be fired by Bill Clinton. Had something to do with the struggle with Tyson's chickens and Purdue chickens out of Maryland. So, but anyway, Mike Epsi is running against her, and it's going to be interesting at the outcome of that, and hopefully he can be successful. There's been some strange things with our brothers and sisters. Medgar Evers' brother, Charles Evers, has endorsed the white supremacist woman for the seat for the Senate. And he is a Republican himself, and I guess he refused the Buck Party. He did endorse her. And as you know, he was clearly a situation, he was in crisis where he had to attempt to try to redo from his brother's death and assassination. I've read and I've understood that he took his brother's assassination and death extremely hard. He has his own little private radio station that he operates. He's been doing that even before his brother was assassinated. And It's a very, I think it's kind of a low power station, and you only can pick it up from that area. But anyway, nevertheless, it now may be on internet because of the fact of the internet structure with radio. But Charles Evers has endorsed her, and anyway, we'll see how it forms out and plays out. She is, as I said, made some very horrible statements going there. But anyway, I want to talk about some of the different things that are going on around us. I want to recap also that reparations thing in Jamaica. What we did yesterday, there's some news from that. And so we kind of wanted to look at just how that change and what it is that we have seen at what has been heard. But first, before I do that, I want to talk a little bit. I had someone that called me last week, well, actually the week before, because we did a sort of a roundtable discussion on things that were going on around us in a very active way. And someone had called and asked about why didn't we make more comments on the Stacey Abrams situation out of Georgia and her losing, and what was that all about, and how is it that African-Americans need to understand that. We were very heavily coached to go out and vote and make sure that those things happen, and I know that there was a major campaign going on to get folks out to vote. There was also some other things that were going on at the same time. Her opponent, Kemp, who is now the governor of Georgia, was also the Secretary of State, and he controlled a lot to do with voting and voting policies. And I'm sure that most of you know that history and that background behind that. But there are some other things I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about and just kind of get an understanding, I think, maybe from history of what may have happened and what is it that we need to understand when these types of elections are being carried forth. Okay, number one, I would say, that you have to consider is that the state of Georgia is a slaveocracy. And I use that word, ocracy, meaning a system of bureaucracy or so forth. It was founded on the system of hardcore chattel slavery. That's its roots. It was the last of the 13 colonies that began. And there were families from England that came here and set this colony up. And it was set up around slavery. There's a lot of land and property here, a lot of farmland that was good to grow cotton and other products that, you know, are here. And so as a result of that slaveocracy system, you know, all the way from the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s to now, has always been in existence. It doesn't go anywhere. We do have a law, supposedly an amendment called the 13th Amendment, that does kill the economic part of that. In other words, you can no longer be chattel. It stopped the chattel part, but it did not end the system of slavery. And so when you talk about a governor or running for office under that, which is the person that oversees the entire state, we are talking about former plantation owners and very powerful people who have had a long time at molding and shaping what happens in this state. Now, Atlanta is clearly, I understand that the city of Atlanta does have some very progressive things going on with African Americans, but no way does that impact the entire state of Georgia. And I applaud Stacey Abrams for taking the initiative to try to do that, but there are some things you would have to look at. The governor, for instance, is responsible for opening the door for commerce to come into this state. He is the one that encourages the big corporations. And Georgia does have a large population of Fortune 500 companies. And actually, it's the governor that has to greet that. He is the one that meets them at the door and welcomes them to the state and makes sure that they are able to get what they want, because obviously when they come, they bring jobs, they bring opportunities, they bring pay taxes supposedly, and they do some other things. So that's a very powerful position just in itself. The other part is that Georgia has an extensive amount of farmland. The agricultural system in the state of Georgia is very powerful. It'd be interesting sometime if you just go take a look at how much of acreage of farmland is still here in Georgia. It's still here. And it's controlled by very powerful families, long-term families who've been around a long time. If you look back at the history of enslavement, Georgia had some of the largest plantations out of the 13 colonies. Georgia and Virginia and North Carolina, South Carolina had very large agricultural plantations. And those plantations were owned by families and had long history. And those families don't go anywhere. They're still around. They change names, and obviously people get married and they crisscross in that way. But that power base is what I'm trying to point out, is still here. It's always there. And so whoever is going to represent that state needs to represent those folks. And so an African-American or anybody who is not of Caucasian bloodline would have to take that in consideration on how to maneuver that. You have counties that were up in the northern part of Georgia that are completely almost lily white. They had all kind of rules and laws against African Americans. Those were towns up there that black folk couldn't go up there after dark. Had all kind of rules and policies like that. And it's still, and a lot of that's still there. Now they may not practice that, obviously, because you've got laws saying you can't, but they practice it in attitude. So you're an African-American, you go up there in one of those counties like that, you will begin to run into the police, who will follow you around, do some of the crazy things that you know people do in predominantly white neighborhoods. So again, then the point is that Georgia is that kind of place. Like Mississippi, like Alabama, it would be very interesting for an African-American to try to run for the governor of Alabama. Mike Epsi is running for the Senate. If he is elected, he will be the first African-American to be elected to that position since Reconstruction. And it's going to be very interesting to see the tie. As you know, Mississippi was hardcore racism, always has been. And I don't think that's changed. And now, this is not to be pessimistic. It's not to talk about that, but it's to talk about the reality, because, again, we'll spend a lot of energy sometimes. We'll spend a lot of resources trying to make things happen by electing folk in positions like that, when somehow or the other that money and those resources can be used in a more effective way to empower the African-American community. If Stacey Abrams would have been elected the governor of Georgia, I'm not sure exactly what she could have done for African Americans specifically, if that was the reason that they were supporting her. Or if you were supporting her just to have a black face in the office, well, okay, then that's all right. But if you were looking for some changes, there's not too much I think we could have expected. Just like during the Obama years, when Obama was elected president, we black folks said, well, what is he going to do for black folks? Nothing. He can't. He represents the United States. African Americans are 12-13% of the population. He represents that other big percentage, and he's going to have to show and represent and do what they say. So you thought maybe he wouldn't be behind the Gaddafi situation because Gaddafi was African American? Well, I think you need to rethink that. He can't do that. He has to do what the status quo of the country wants him to do, whoever that is. And whoever that is that was behind him that's doing that. And it's the same thing for the governor. And, or as that matter of fact, a mayor or a senator or a House of Representatives person. Now, the House of Representatives is a little bit different because many times that position represents a sort of cluster. And it represents a cluster of a community which may sometimes be a predominant ethnic group. And so most of the times, the House of Representatives folks are representing areas where African Americans are highly populated. And so a lot of times things that they try to ask for and get, they can do that because of the fact that they represent that one area. But again, when they get into the Congress, they have to be able to negotiate, cut deals, make pacts, things like that. I've always said that the political office is not a place to fight liberation and change for African American people. Now, I'm willing to take a tongue licking from anybody on that, but I really do believe that it is not the arena to do that. I do not think that running for governor, running for U.S. senator, is going to make it so that life will be better in that area for African-American people. It will encourage other blacks to get into the political participation, maybe. But I think the question I'm having is that the resources sometimes that has to be expended to get folks like that elected, and then you run up against those brick walls when you see that you know you can't buck that, I think needs to be reviewed. And sometimes spending a waste of money and time to do that. And that's what happened to Stacey Abrams. She cannot buck that slaveocracy in Georgia. No African-American can do that. Yes, Atlanta had black mayors back-to-back, got one now. That's different. It's not the same as the governor. It's not the same as the senator, a senator from Georgia. That's not the same way it works. It works a lot different when it comes to those positions. And the corporations, the Coca-Colas, the Delta Airlines, the SunTrust Banks, Mercedes-Benz, and all of those big, mega 500 corporations depend upon having one of the good old boys that is there to support them and get through their agenda so that their stockholders will be pleased with what goes on. I just saw a clipping the other day that, and I think I did put it out on Facebook, where Land of Lakes Butter Company out of Minnesota, the corporate head wrote a check to support the campaign of one of the hardcore racists, Trump supporter, Confederate flag waving senators from Minnesota, and a person who has clearly stated his disdain for African people and minorities, and who has leaned toward that far, far right for a long time. Well, Land O' Lakes Butter decided to support him because that's what they want, because he represents supporting how that operates. Land O' Lakes, as you know, is a farming conglomerate. It's owned by a group of farmers. It's no one specific person. It's owned by a group of farmers, but it is a very powerful corporation. But nevertheless, the call was to boycott Land O' Lakes for supporting things like that. Well, I'm pretty sure if somebody does the research, that you will find the same thing with this past election. I'm pretty sure that your big major corporations here were probably supporting Kemp. He was the former Secretary of State, which in a sense he carries the seal and the things that regulate corporations here and their position. He had an opportunity to pull some strings during the election that you would not know and nobody would be able to know because, he is the Secretary of State. So if anything, in a symbolic way, it would have been better to put a lot more energy into getting him out as Secretary of State so that that would clear up those channels that were open for that. And so that, and obviously that didn't happen. But I think we need to realize that. More than likely, Mr. Kemp has a Negroocracy group that he probably supports and that supports him, that paved the way. We may or may not know who they are, just like the situation in Mississippi. And I use that word Negroocracy in the same way I use the word slaveocracy. The Negroocracy are African people who supposedly would say that they represent their communities, but in a sense they do not. They represent their own self-interest and are willing to back up unfriendly kind of folks just to get their own situation moving forward. And so the Negroocracy, which is always that buffer zone that you lose, were more than likely right in there at the during all of this election. So in the future, I think that we as African-American community need to take in consideration a more understanding about the seats of power when you're representing folk. I remember there was a brother a couple of months ago, well, actually, maybe about a year ago, that wanted to run for governor of Dallas, Texas. And he was out there campaigning and getting donations for his position. I admire his braveness. Would not by any means discourage him, but I would say to him, brother, you need to think that out a little bit. You need to look at where the power lays in Texas. And we know where it lays in Texas. But before you launch out there, spend all of that money, waste all of that time trying to run for a position, unless you're just trying to do something to boost your own background and your own status, then that's a different kind of story. So, yes, we want to vote. But my point is think first and weigh this thing out before you launch out there and put a lot of energy in some things that we haven't well thought out. So that's to the brother that emailed me, and I know I see he's watching, he's listening. That's my take on Stacey Abrams. I would welcome any of you that might be on that would like to maybe make a point. I'm open to do that. I'll call that number here is area code 215-490-9832. And so you have your intake on the Stacey Abrams situation and why she didn't win. I'm open to do that. You can give us a call. Okay. The other area that I wanted to talk about is there's some information. I decided to do a little research because I was really interested in the incident that took place on those islands, the Andaman Islands, out in the Pacific, and what that was all about. We were on Brother Elliot's program on Sunday, and we kind of talked about it just a little bit, about what some of the things that were going on and what some of all of that meant. And one of the things very clearly that you would have to take in consideration, there is some, number one, I would be willing to say that there is not one piece of land anywhere on the planet Earth that's not owned or controlled by some power source outside of the inhabitants that live on it. Every piece of it. All of those Pacific islands were either under the control of the British, the Portuguese, the Dutch, whoever had those big ships, they are the ones that went in and they controlled those islands. Now, they didn't live there. In some cases, they may have looked for resources. They didn't get the resources, but they kept the ownership of the land. Well, these islands that we're talking about, I think we have been bamboozled on what took place on that island. The natives may have killed that missionary. They may have been the one that did that. But the way we're getting the story is not the way it is. India owns that island. India has always owned that island. They have been there. They have a controlling mechanism. They've done studies. And so when you hear the news that these natives would run anybody away that came there that weren't like them, that's false. And the evidence to support that is that there was a study done of those islands by people that went in there and visited. And what they're in there for is to see what resources were there that were usable by the India government. So the Andaman Islands is owned by India. And I'm going to give you some information, because India did what they called an industrial profile of all of those. And they created a printed document that is available for us to see. And there are some valuable resources on their island. And most of those islands, based on the interaction of sun and water, have produced some raw material products that are available nowhere else on the planet Earth. And these are medicinal products. They can be used for medicine. And India has that under control, and India has been taking that material to do it. They know exactly what's there. They did an industrial profile of that island. And so I'm going to give you, for your own information, I'm going to give you the name of that study. It was called The Industrial Profile of the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. The Industrial Profile of Andaman and the Nicobar Islands. It was done by what's called the MSME Development Institute in India. And I think that that's online. So if you want to Google that name, the MSME, which is an acronym, Development Institute. And what that means, it means micro, small, and medium enterprises. Micro, small, and medium enterprises. That was the initiative. And what they were doing is that they were going there to trying to determine what materials were available. And there was a lot of fauna that was there, could be used. There were also animal life there. I don't know, those animals, islands. And yes, those natives were there, and the India left them there. And they also, in some ways, have supported them in other kinds of things, but they let them stay there untouched. My speculation is that they did that as their sort of like their security system, because a lot of the countries around the world have been exploring those Pacific islands looking for medicinal products that can be used in medical research. And so if they can get there first and get them, then obviously they'll take them and obviously begin to make some things happen. Well, even though they say that young man was a missionary, it may be that he may not have been a missionary. He may have been there to do some scientific exploration and to look at what was there. But take a look at this report. And once you take a look at that report, it will change your mind about all of this. Because we were made to believe that this was a missionary going to go onto this island and help the people convert folk to Christianity. Come on. One person going on an island, a whole bunch of natives, that's not going to happen. Not like that. It's going to take a little bit more effort to do that. Particularly, you don't know anything about him, don't know anything about that. He may have looked. He was going there to look for resources, to look at what product life was there, and began to obviously take that back to wherever he was working for, or whoever he was involved in. Those islands are very rich in material. They're very rich in plant life. And so there's a possibility. You have others. You have Madagascar, which is out in the Indian Pacific Ocean, right off of Mozambique. It's rich minerals. I mean minerals like you wouldn't believe. Bauxite, cobalt, material for copper. All of that is in there. And a lot of that is unexplored. That's one of the fights that have been going on in Mozambique. for those raw materials. And there's been serious trouble with that. It may very well be that the Arab world has gotten hold of some of that. And the Indonesians are being used as a way of going in and helping one of the larger powers to seize those goods. So if the Arabs were looking to take those raw materials, and they use the Indonesians as a method of getting to that, and then the Indonesians obviously would be well compensated for what they've done and being able to have access to a lot of that stuff. It's been going on for a long time. The British were at that for years. That's the reason why they and the French have so much influence on those South Pacific islands, places like Tahiti, even in Australia. We know what the British did in Australia, and that's because of the resources. There are resources there. Now, they're not big land. You're not going to go there and find a whole lot of diamonds and gold and things like that. But that's not always the most valuable resource. Medicinal stuff. There may be things out there that can cure diseases like AIDS, and cancer, and Alzheimer's, and different kinds of things. And you have to go get that plant life in order to do that. And those islands very well may possess that. And so what we were looking at with this situation was an economics issue, not missionary. This was economics, strictly economics. And India has control of all of that area. So take a look at that industrial profile of the Andaman, A-N-D-A-M-A-N, and the Nicobar Islands. And the name of the organization that did the study was the Micro, Small, and Medium Enterprise. They are the ones that did. And once you read the document, and you'll see very clearly, it's very detailed. And they have listed all of the products, how much is there, what the population is, and it was even developed as a job training area from people from India were going there. So this wasn't some mystique island that nobody knew about. That's incorrect. That was bamboozled. We had been bamboozled on that. And so once you do see that and once you understand it, you'll very clearly know that this was another one of those things that we find that happens to us a lot of times. Okay, one other thing I did want to mention about that, I remember when even though this was a remote island, but they've done that with all the islands. Even America was done that way. Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark on an expedition out into the unknown chartered land of the West looking for stuff to see what was there. Now, he had some specific goals. They were looking for a passageway to the Pacific to see if there was some kind of a waterway system. They were looking also at how extensive the Native American communities were and what is it going to be like to penetrate that and take those lands, obviously, and be able to conquer them and so it can seize that land. And the other thing they were looking for was what is the plant life? What grows out there? What can we use? What can be used as food, clothing, and shelter? What was the timber life like? And so I think one of the things that helps us a lot is when we're studying issues and seeing this, we have to do our history. We have to be very critical and analytical, particularly if you have an interest in some of this. And we have to do our history. We have to look at the way the process is going. And the dominant and controlling factor of economic systems and political systems is the acquisition of food, clothing, and shelter. That is the dominating force. Food, clothing, and shelter. Whoever controls that controls the game. And that's what we see a lot of times being played out in the world. And very clearly, India has a large control of those Pacific islands. They're part of it. Indonesia has a large part of it. The British are still there in some areas. The French are there in some areas. The Solomon Islands, America's there too. Fuji, that's Japan. And there's a lot of stuff going on out there, a lot of commerce. And nobody's going to buck that without obviously going to war. So Take a look at that profile, and I think you will be very clear. Again, you're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I'm William Rogers. We're just kind of doing a look at some of the things that are going on around us. We had a brother that was supposed to come on today, but he took gravely sick, ill, and has a bad cold, so he couldn't make it. So I just said, well, maybe we just talk a little bit. And I welcome your comments and your suggestions and your questions as we move along with them. Our discussion at looking at some of these issues. So we wanted to address the Stacey Abrams issues. We addressed this whole thing with the missionary being killed and so forth, and what that was all about. Now, last week we did the film with we talked to the filmmaker that did the part about the reparations, the price of memory, and the Rastafarian objective to go after reparations, sued the Queen. Obviously, they lost the case, but some interesting things were revealed about the case and what needs to happen in order to fight it, and what some of the obstacles are, and what the next group that's going to come back and take this case to court would have to do as well. Well, in between all of this, there some news came out last week that a European university, University of Glasgow, had agreed to pay reparations, and the reparations would be given to the University of the West Indies, which is a conglomerate of schools in Jamaica, Trinidad, Tobago, and other areas of the Caribbean. And the amount was £200, which is very clearly in the billions of dollars today, that they had agreed to do that because the University of Glasgow had profited tremendously from the slave trade. The University of Glasgow was one of the ancient universities of the world. It was started in the 1400s, and it was started from a papal bull by, I think it was Pope Nicholas. And the university was designed to get ready to get into the scientific revolution that was beginning to take force in the world. And one of the things was the navigation of the oceans and the water, and shipbuilding, and maritime science. And so the University of Glasgow would be a key center. And there were others, and it was a huge venture that would take on, and that they profited tremendously from that venture of training, you know, individuals who would participate in the maritime part of that. And so they felt that, well, we had made so much money then that we need to do something and pay back the reparations to the University of the West Indies. Well, bamboozle, that wasn't correct. There was an article that came out that said that they had not agreed to do that. And the newspaper that published that was one of the Jamaican papers called The Gleaner, and it came out with the incorrect information on that. The vice chancellor that we kept seeing was Professor Sir Hilary Beckles. He was the front figure in all of this, and it was not true. They did not agree to do that. It has been discussed to do something, but not that, not yet. Now, that's not to say that it won't happen, but that was incorrect. And so one of the other papers called The Guardian, which is out of Trinidad, was able to report correctly just what happened. So it's in limbo. There is no reparations to the University of the West Indies, not as of yet. But it's interesting, even if that does happen, it has definitely opened up an excellent conversation avenue to do that. And one of the things that I would ask, if it's reparations, meaning repair, why is it going to be paid to the University of the West Indies? because a lot of the University of the West Indies is owned by Britain, or has Britain has control of it, or something they do with it. Most of the chancellors of the University of the West Indies have been Britons. I think it's Queen Victoria's daughter was once one of the first chancellors. So a lot of the resources and the funds and the money of the University of the West Indies in its creation and organization and its donors are basically Europeans. So if they're going to give reparations to the University of the West Indies, they're going to be giving it to European sources, which may use it to create educational institutions or create training for the inhabitants that live in the Caribbean. But my point is, why call it reparations? It's not reparations. This reparation has to be is defined differently, and it has been defined by some of the groups exactly what that is. What is reparations? And that's, you know, for another discussion, but why are they going to call that reparations? And so in one of the documents that was coming forth about the possibility of it, if it was given, they were adamant that they wanted it related to be called reparations. And so I wondered, why is that necessary? Because that's not going to trickle down to the folk that are suffering because of the transatlantic slave trade by Britain and the other European nations in the Caribbean. That's not going to even impact in any way. Yes, they'll be able to go to school. The tuition may be free, things like that. There may be things that are created that they can use and go elsewhere. That's just not the same thing. And I think that they are bamboozling us by calling it that. And so I would like to see something else done with that. I talked to Mrs. Karen. I talked to Karen today. We didn't get into the discussion of it. I had asked her if she has an opportunity to please call in and give us some of the perspective from, you know, her viewpoint, because I know she's facing it right on. But it has nothing to do with what the Rastafarians were asking for. They were asking for repatriation money and direct reparations to go back to Africa. And that's not being done. So again, we're being bamboozled. I think one of the things that I looked at, if they can get this done, then what happens is the reparations movement will begin to, they would set the pace for how any future monies would be paid, where it would not be paid directly to the recipient, but it will be paid to the institution like this. And I have always said that if you're going to pay reparation, I would not approve, I personally do not think that giving it so that you would have education opportunities or you might be able to use it to buy a house and all of that, no. I need to be able to purchase, we need to be able to purchase land in large amounts, be able to create an industry, take that money and develop an industry for African people. Go to Africa and exchange that with the African nations. And let's all work together in that way if you're going to try to do it on an institutional basis. So this is very interesting. It is a, you can look on the internet and Google The Guardian. This is Guardian is a paper from Trinidad, and they have reported that in detail. Brother Griffin had sent me a clip that he had seen where he saw the whole idea that this was not real. And so therefore it's obviously out there on the internet. So for those of you who are interested in that, you can take a look. The University of Glasgow is not going to pay reparations as of yet the way it had been originally reported. The university was a part of the Catholic Church system, who was the forefront of the slave trade. again, I raised the question, is that going, who's going to pay reparations for the soul of African people? And that's just not enough. And if you're going to do it, it has to be done different. You know, it's always been a funny thing for me about the whole issue of reparations. It really has. It's like a seesaw. I mean, the idea that people are going to pay back for the problem, but I don't think, from what I feel and from the ancestral blood that runs in my body, that that's enough. That's not efficient to give me money. And I mean, I'm like anybody else. I'd like to get my check, too. But at the same time, that's not going to address what was done and the mental anguish that was done in that system. That's not going to redress that. You could take that money and build one of the biggest mental health clinics in the world. That's still not going to handle what was done out of that system. And then the question would come out, well, what would handle? What can we do? Nothing. You can't make people forget that. But I do say that there can be some ways, but it has to be unrestricted kind of stuff. See, and that's the problem. Everybody wants to go and put a restriction on it. And you can do this with it, you can do that, this person will be available, this one or that. No. Even like the case of the Native Americans and what they're getting in those areas. The Native Americans are not benefiting. You know, the grassroots Native Americans are not benefiting from those casinos. That's not what's happening. You know, that's what it looks like on the surface. But that's not what's happening. Those casinos in the hands of very powerful and wealthy Europeans. The Bally Corporation, that's who benefiting from the casinos. And a lot of those slot machines. You know, yeah, the casino makes money from you putting the money in the machine, but the real money is the slot machine. Who's paying for those? Who gets the benefit from buying 5,000 slot machines in a casino? Where's that money going? Who's benefiting, you know, out of that? The real estate that the casinos are in, where is that? Who owns that land? Native Americans? I think we would have to look at that. So anyway, that whole reparations idea and paying money for repair, if it's going to do anything, it has to be done unrestricted. And if there were benefits that were gained, and that we know that there were, then those just have to be laid on the table and let everybody come to a conclusion on how to, you know, how to do that. It would have to be those who were the descendants of the victims. That's number one. The victimizer can't be the one to determine how that's going. All you do is put the money up, let the victims do it. And I know that's unrealistic, but, you know, I'm just have often struggled with that whole idea and how to make that happen. So anyway, we'll still be looking at, hopefully, at some of the action that's going to be taken to find out just how the reparations plight will go, and what will take place, and the way it will take place. It's going to be very interesting. One of the things that I wanted to mention also is this whole thing with trauma that African people go through, from chattel slavery, violence, terrorism, and all of these things that, you know, we know have happened right now, these police shootings, the killing of the young brother in the mall, and how that traumatizes folks, and what that's doing to the community as a whole, and how sometimes it's subtle, and we sometimes are critical about folks who are victimized by that trauma. And one of them is Charles Evers, that situation with Charles. And I thought about it in looking at the issue with Charles Evers. Charles Evers was 100% traumatized behind the murder and assassination of his brother by J.D. LeBeckwith. J.D. LeBeckwith was a rabid racist. He was one of the worst that I have ever seen, because he philosophically and logically talked about why and what he thought of African people. He said that African people were bite creatures. He said some ugly stuff. And he said the only way you're going to be able to deal with them is you got to control them. And he said all kind of different. That's very traumatic to know that. And he did that during the trial. He did that during the shooting. And then after he was found not guilty the first time, and how he confessed, Charles Evers was traumatized. And he probably has never gotten over that. And that has happened to a lot of African Americans in the South based on all of these crazy kinds of things. We talked about on this show Recy Taylor, the rape of Recy Taylor, how those white boys raped that young girl in the woods, and when they had finished doing what they did, they still was in interaction with her, threatening her not to tell. And even though she was married, it traumatized her husband. Because you got to imagine this now. Your wife has just been raped by five young men, and you cannot do a damn thing about it. He was so traumatized that he had gotten his shotgun and went and sat on the front porch with the shotgun on his lap because he couldn't go after them, so he just sat there. And they said in the documentary, he sat there all night long on the front porch with the shotgun in his lap because he couldn't do anything about it. And with his wife in the house, probably still bleeding from the rape of these four or five boys who brutally raped her. And then, on top of that, she would have to live the rest of her life always knowing that. She would run across them in the street, at the store, and places like that, and see that, and do nothing, nothing she could do. So the point that I'm making, that's trauma that is very hard for people to understand who are not a part of that. It's very difficult for us to understand how that takes on. So what we do is I've been looking on here on Facebook, folks attacking Charles Evers about supporting this woman. And maybe that is, it's not good. I mean, I'll be the first to say that. But he's being called a coon, and he's being called all kinds of different names, which I think is the wrong approach to handle that. He's probably about 86 years old, 88, maybe a little older. He looked well in the picture. That's a current picture of him. But he's been dealing with his brother's death for a long time. I have had an opportunity to listen to some of his radio broadcasts, and he talks about it all the time. And so I think that those kinds of things, when we look at this trauma, I look at parents who are on television after their sons have been killed. The mother that was on television, the young man that was shot in the mall by the Alabama police, and what she was going to, and how she was having to deal with the way her son was killed, and what that was doing to her personally. That immediately taxed not only your psychology, it attacks your physical body. Your blood pressure rises. Your heart beats funny and fast. And it's killing us as a people. So my question has, and still is, and has always been, what are we going to do about this? Are we going to continue to sit and talk? What I'm doing is my great-grandchild going to talk about this, be talking about this 20, 30 years from now in the same way? Or is there going to be some kind of action that is taken to fight back in some kind of way? And I can't suggest a way, because you would have to understand the body of people that would do it. You have to be able to understand it from that perspective. But how do we continue to let these folks kill our children? How much longer are we going to allow that to happen? What are we going to do? What interests are we going to go after that can stop that? We write books. We look at documentaries. We got radio programs like this, and we talk, and we go back and forward. But how do we understand that we have to do something and not just talk about it? How do we do that? So my question then for us to consider as we approach 2019 and then eventually 2020 and that 400-year period of time that everybody told us we're all in, how and when do you do that? And how do you do it? And who's going to do it? And what needs to be done? We can't march anymore. The teddy bears on the telegram pole is not going to help. The flowers around the memorial is not going to help. The candlelight vigils are nice and beautiful. I'm not saying don't do those. I'm just simply saying there has to be something else along with it. That's what our ancestors have been telling us. When we come back, I'm going to take a quick break. And area code 215-490-9832 for anyone that would like to make a suggestion, talk, give your comments. Doing that a little bit different this day than we normally do. But I see if Brother Griffin wants to say something when we come back from our break, talk about some of those things. So let's take a quick musical break, and we're going to come back and get right to the discussion and close out the day looking at a lot of the issues that affect us around.
We are African, and we happen to be in America. We're not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America. Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us. We were brought here against our will. We were not brought here to be made citizens. We were not brought here to enjoy the constitutional gifts that they speak so beautifully about today. And because we weren't brought here to be made citizens today, now that we've become awakened to some degree and we begin to ask for those things which they say are supposedly for Americans, they look upon us with hostility and unfriendliness. If you're interested in freedom, you need some judo, you need some karate, you need all the things that will help you fight for freedom. Nationalism is the wave of the present and the future. It is nationalism that's bringing freedom to oppressed people all over the world. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Algerians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Nigerians and to the Ghanaians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the people of Uganda and Tanganyika and Sudan and Somaliland. The Africans didn't get it by sitting in. They didn't get it by waiting in. They didn't get it by singing, "We Shall Overcome." They got it through nationalism. And you and I will get it through nationalism. What is it that makes it difficult for the philosophy of nationalism to spread among the so-called Negroes? Number one, they think they have a stake in America. They think they have an investment in this country, which we do. We invested 310 years of slave labor, 310 years, every day of which your and my mother and father worked for nothing, not 8 hours a day. There was no union in that day. They worked from sun up until sundown, from can't see in the morning until can't see at night. They never had a day off. And on Sunday, they were allowed to sit down and sing about when they die, they wouldn't be slaves no more. When they die, they wouldn't be slaves no more. They'd go up in the sky, and every day would be Sunday. That's a shame. And it is that 310 years of slave labor that went in, that was my and your contribution into this particular economy and political system. Make him give us the back pay. Let's join in. If this is what the Negro wants, let's join him. Let's show him how to struggle. Let's show him how to fight. Let's show him how to bring about a real revolution. Let's make him stop jiving. You don't need a debate. You don't need a filibuster. You need some action.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Okay, my brothers and sisters, we are back. The words from the great ancestor, Malcolm X, and I think those are crucial understanding that we must have. We're putting too much focus that we've won complete citizenship in this country. We have not won complete citizenship in this country. You are not seen yet as a full American. It's what John Hope Franklin said about the Africans that were walking free during captivity. He called them quasi-free. We are quasi-citizens. We have some rights. There's some things we can do, have a right to do, that we didn't maybe have to do during enslavement. But you don't have full political access, because if you did, you wouldn't have to have a Voting Rights Act. You wouldn't have had the kind of mess you had going on in that election in Georgia. You wouldn't have police officers shooting your children, and you can't do anything about it if you were full citizens. Full citizens are not treated that way in the country, unless you're in a country like Russia or somewhere like that. That's a different story. But when you've got somebody talking about freedom and liberty and justice and all and democracy and all of those words we hear, and your grandmother gets stopped by a police officer and thrown up against the car and treated and beat it, and you can't do anything about it, that's not citizenship. So I think Malcolm's words are crucial that we need to listen to. And I know the question becomes, well, what do we do? That's why we're here on Tuesday night, 8 to 10. That's why I call this the Black Reality Think Tank. We got to stimulate something that can change the way we see ourselves, first of all, as in this slaveocracy. Because we are in a slaveocracy. We're still here. We're still in a slaveocracy. We're still a part of a system where we were in captivity. We've never gotten out of that. And we are also in a warlike way. I mean, I know war is when you got two opposing sides fighting each other. We're not fighting anybody. We're just being victimized. But we are in a battle here for our lives, for our children's lives. And there are times like this where it escalates. And you hear things that it shocks you sometimes. You get shocked by that. Shocked by the young brother that was shot in the mall by the police officer. he's all justifying why, and he didn't know, and this and that, and then they backing him up, and I'm sure that some white organization is going to fund his legal defense fund, and, you know, and same old thing. Okay, Brother Griffin, you got a thought? You know, I know I've been doing most of the talking. A lot of our folks, I'm not sure where they are tonight, but that's okay. Any thoughts you have, just anything minor?
Yes, sir, I do. You really covered a lot.
Thank you.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you good. Uh-huh.
Okay, you've been touching on a lot of things, Doctor, and part of what I keep saying, and I've fought it personally for 40 years, and I don't want to try to surround this whole thing around me, but the thing I find most interesting is a lot of our people, very smart people, want to think that we can look back on the history, distant and the recent history, and just make it work for today. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, a brother, I saw a quote today, and I put it here in the chat. It says, it is the job of the youth folks today to carry on the struggle by studying their history and understanding the mistakes that were made, trying to carry on the successes for this time, because you can't really take what was done in 1968 and just transport it to the day.
Right.
And that's a brother, Sekou Odinga. That was a Black Panther. Now, my point to you is that quote to me says everything that we keep struggling with, because I hear so many people come on and say, we can just go back to Africa, we can go to the motherland. I try not to get into those binary arguments with people because it's more than that. That can be your goal, but we have to do something like you've been saying tonight. We have to figure out what we're going to do now so we can have a future.
Right.
And part of that is understanding how the enemy works. I'm going to give you a perfect example. Have you ever heard of the Billionaires for Poverty?
No, I haven't.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. No, I haven't. I haven't heard that. Brother Griffin?
Are you there?
Yeah, I hear you. Can you hear me? Brother Griffin?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Uh-huh. I hear
you. Okay,
I
say, have you heard of the group, the Billionaires for Poverty?
No, I have not heard of them.
I'm going to give you a quick rundown right quick of what they are. So, okay. When I say we have to study what's going on today, I hear people talk about all you have to do is pool your money. All we have to do is take back our neighborhoods. But we have to understand this is about the third time in this country's history that we've had the kind of wealth disparity, not just from Black people, but poor white people too. I mean, meaning that 10% of the population owns about 80% of the wealth in the whole nation.
Right.
So you're looking at 500 billionaires and maybe 10,000 to maybe 100,000 white people that own the rest. So we have to look at what they're doing that's totally different than 1968. And when I ask you, do you know about the Billionaires for Poverty, I'm going to give you a quick rundown of who they are. Part of them is the Ballmer Group, B-A-L-L-M-E-R, Gates Foundation, and Bloomberg Philanthropies.
Okay, yeah, no Bloomberg.
Now, here's what they're doing. I'm going to try not to eat up a lot of time. I'm going to tell you what they're doing.
Okay.
They've actually started. Now, guess who they brought into the fold now? Originally, that was the original part of the group. But they bought in also Mark Zuckerberg, Sergey Brin, and Jeff Bezos. That's three more of the richest white men in America.
Right.
So that's Bill Gates, Michael Bloomberg, and Steve Ballmer, along with three other of the richest billionaires. They recently pledged $2 billion for homelessness and early childhood education. But guess what that's being done under? Philanthropy. To make it easy for you, what that means to me is they see poverty as a long-term investment and a revenue stream.
Right.
They're not trying to solve a problem. They're not trying to give you reparations. They're trying to figure out how to do what? Make a profit off of your poverty.
Right, off of poverty.
And our people, no matter what you say, when I talk to some of these people that are running history departments and all of that, they don't seem to understand that. Philanthropy and your good-heartedness, your charity, is not reparations. It's not equality. It's not life-giving. Mm-hmm. And so when I say our people, we got to start educating our children on what's going on with this. Now, they just pledged $2 billion, but they started with a $12 million donation. So that tells you right there, look at the gap between $12 million to start and an already manifest goal of contributing $2 billion. They're not giving that $2 billion in an investment with no idea of return. So what's that mean? Here's how they're trying to spend it. They already started in L.A. That's how I ended up starting searching for this, because I work with an activist that's in L.A. Uh-huh. They started telling me about this group called Liberty Hill, another Jewish Hell Foundation. Right. That is doing the very same thing in L.A. Guess what they're doing? They're recruiting our youth, sending them out to protest in their communities over dilapidated housing. Then they come in and do what? Direct city funds toward cleaning up and rejuvenating that area. So they're using the very residents, the youth that live there in poverty, making them think they're doing something good, and all they're doing is opening the door and greasing the wheels for gentrification.
That's exactly right.
And when you try to tell this to some of these educated people here in this country, they don't want to hear it. Right. Well, that's good. We no longer have dilapidated houses. But I'm not saying don't bring an investment. What I'm saying is, when you bring in that investment, when you make these enterprise zones, the people who have lived there for generations should have a right to live. That should be the part of the reparations. You should be able to have your home fixed properly. Okay. You should be able to create land trust to make sure when you close your eyes, whether you live a long life or you die tomorrow with a heart attack, that it goes to who? Your descendants. Not that some bank gets to come in and say you didn't pay the note, so you lose it.
That's exactly right.
I'm going to kind of stop right there, because I get passionate about this, and I get tired of arguing with people that I know have more degrees and plaques than I do, but they don't seem to have any common sense when it comes to figuring out how this really works in the real world. Sometimes you got to be willing to understand what you don't know.
Right. How to use it. Exactly right. You're right about that. We got Brother Marcus, but before I bring Brother Marcus on, I just want to say I got a clipping from one of the news agencies that 20% of the polls have reported in Mississippi, and Cindy Hyde-Smith has a 55% lead over Mike Epsi, who has 44.5% of the vote. How that equates in terms of numbers. Cindy Hyde-Smith is 82,674 votes. Mike Epsi has 66,405. But that's 20% of the precincts. So we can see as the day goes on, as the votes continue, how things are going. Brother Marcus, how you doing?
Dr. Rogers.
Yes.
Can I say one more thing? Sure. I agree with you wholeheartedly when you brought up the point about putting so much time, energy, and these small donations into trying to win a governorship. Right. When the truth is, our people should be donating to block these people that are trying to come in and steal your neighborhood. That's why I get upset when I try to communicate with people like Sherry Lynn Eiffel at NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Right. If you're not protecting these neighborhoods when all across the country black neighborhoods are disappearing, what good is the NAACP Legal Defense Fund?
None. And you see, and you've got even the power of politicians that we have, and those that are outspoken, the Maxine Waters, the Cory Bookers, and all of them. They speak well. They got powerful voices, but they can't do anything.
And they won't tell the truth. As a matter of fact, I was talking to some people. I do abolition. That's my main focus. I love listening to your program because it kind of gives me a little bit of break from that. But I'll make the point. this first step bill that they're talking about, reform in the prison and the criminal sentencing, people aren't understanding that bill is not definitive. It was written in the House. It has all kind of loopholes in it. Right. And I'll give you a quick one. They're talking about this is transformative change. The truth is, the way it's written, guess who decides which one of the prisons gets to make changes?
Who's that?
The Attorney General of the Department of Justice gets to determine which prisons will enact this first. So what do you think is going to happen? They're going to cherry pick one or two prisons that they want to use to bring in the philanthropy of the Koch brothers with these reformative changes and your chance to get out. Right. Then they let certain people out, and they let them out under what I call e-incarceration. You're going to have electronic monitoring hooked to you. Your family pays for it. That's a burden for your family. That's so right. You're no longer in a cage, but you're still electronically monitored. And then the law says if you miss payments or you don't show up, you don't even have to go back to court. It's an administrative thing. You're right back in jail.
Right back in
so
jail.
So the only good thing I saw is everybody in the CBC voted against it.
Right.
Now, my problem with them is out of those 43 or 44 people that voted against it, they did the right thing to vote against it, but they won't come out publicly and tell you what I just said to you, and they know what's in the bill.
Right.
So that tells me they got too much dirt on them, because they figure if they tell the truth to us and make people rise up and try to demand some changes, they ain't going to get elected the next time around. Right. They're more concerned with their career than they are with telling the truth.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Brother Marcus, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you.
Dr. Rogers.
Yes, sir.
400 years is long enough to know. Next year will be 400 years. And we haven't been able to work out any honorable relationship in 400 years.
Right.
So it is evident that the powers that be have no intention of working out anything honorable with black people here. And let's see at the bottom. Organization is everything here, Dr. Rogers. That's what Nelson Mandela said when he came out of prison. He said, organization is everything.
Right.
All else is hardy. Okay?
Right.
We got to organize ourselves to get the hell out of this country, my brother. There ain't no solution for black people here. You know? We talk about sovereignty. You think they're going to give us any land here in America?
Right.
You think they're going to partition off any place in America and say, okay, black people, this is yours? No. Tulsa, Oklahoma has demonstrated that.
Right.
You're not going to build no black empire in America.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who was in the movement, and the FBI came and arrested him. And you know what the French agent told him? He said, look, you ain't going to build no black empire here in America.
Never.
Okay? Because we were the tools they used to build America.
That's right.
We were the hammer. We were the star. They don't give the hammer. The carpenter, when he build a building, he don't give the hammer and the saw credit. He don't say, oh, yes, I thank the hammer and the saw for building the country. No, he say he thank himself.
Right.
See? The only solution is African nationalism. Ain't nothing else short of that. And organize ourselves to get out of this country.
Right.
No, if they block you from getting out of the country, you're going to be forced to fight. Okay?
Right.
There is
exactly.
No other option. Okay? So, I mean, as I said, 400 years is long enough to know. We have to look at experience. We have to look at the history and experience of us in this country. And we have been here before at this point.
Right.
This ain't not new with us in this country. A person like Trump being in office, it ain't nothing new. It's just a resurgence, you know? So, we have to look at Mr. Garvey's plan. He had the best plan.
Yes, he did.
Everybody came, followed Garvey, and moved ahead. The Chinese came and said, oh, you know that sound intelligent? Asia to the Asiatic. Boom. they moved ahead. The Indian came in there for the boom, they moved ahead. We're the only ones standing around wondering, oh, well, which direction we should go.
Right.
That's how terrible that damage that was done to our mind, the psychological damage that was done to the black mind, has never been corrected. And you're not going to correct it in the nut house.
Right.
It is the nut house.
It sure
you're going to correct the problem in the nut house.
Exactly what it is.
No. It is a jail. You're in jail here. So, a dynamic Pan-Africanism is the solution for black people.
Right.
Why should we stay here and deprive the red man of his land? The red man still wants his land back. He still wants America back.
Right.
But we're going to say, oh, you know, forget about him. We're going to stay here with the white man and fight it. Come on, let's be for real, black people. You know?
Right.
You know, the mind of our people is so twisted. Ain't no solution to you here.
Right.
And I tell you, the world is watching what's going on.
Right.
You see? And the world they be set up with this foolishness sooner. You see?
Right.
And we here hanging out with him. So whatever gets the world that's this crap up, we won't catch it too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
An old time person said, never hang out with a fool. Because when the fool catcher come, I said, never argue with a fool. Because when the fool catcher come, you don't know who the damn fool is.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
African redemption. That is, Africa is calling us. You know, and irrespective of the leadership in Africa, we know that they got a lot of flunkies in Africa. We know that they're Europeans. But we still can't let that prevent us from moving to our people.
Mm-hmm.
People set up for them, their Negroes in Africa. You know, that theory that they cement ourselves in is the mass majority of our people. And agitating them, we sweep all them niggas up. I'm telling you.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
So the time is right. The time is now.
Now. I agree.
You're good, brother.
Amen. Thank you so much. Appreciate you, Brother Marcus. Thank you. Our call-in number here is 215-490-9832. We welcome your call. We've got about 30 minutes left. You can please give us a call and give us your input, your thoughts in terms of our discussion. It was just sort of a free-form discussion about all the different things that are impacting us. We hopefully can energizing the will for people to look at their environment a little bit more critically, like most animals do in the animal kingdom. One of the things that they always do there is they assess their environment. And then when you build from the assessment of your environment. That's where you build from. And as Brother Marcus said, you know, and Brother Griffin, you can't go back and look at 1950 and build from there. Because it was a different environment. We've got another whole environment. And so any program, any agenda that we attempt to create is going to have to be created from the agenda of the current environment. And there are some dynamics to this environment that are very strange. And a lot of it has to do is that we are doing a lot of things in maintaining our own enslavement. There's a lot we're doing from our community. I was reading an article the other day that here in Atlanta, there's really kind of a war going on right now among a group of collective black businesses over the control of strip clubs. You've got several large scale strip clubs here in Atlanta, and that they are battling over control, you know. And what is the control? The women, and getting them there and being able to pay decent wages to them, which they're not. They're usually being clearly exploited. The key of getting folk, obviously patrons, and positioning themselves for that. they had two big strip clubs here that kind of went to war with each other over some things that were being done. And a lot of the business of those strip clubs are locked into music. The rap industry, the hip-hop industry is connected to that. And so we're fighting. So your daughters, who are sliding up and down these poles for black men, who are making thousands, I'm not going to say they're making millions, they're making thousands of dollars getting paid. I just understand from one of the articles, and this is just based on the article. I don't know if it's actually true or not, but T.I., the rapper T.I. has just bought one of those clubs, and now he has one. Jermaine Dupri had one, and they own one of those big strip clubs. And who's in the strip club? Who are they dealing with? Well, your daughters. And I would pray to God that I would not suddenly ever find that one of my daughters is sliding up one of those poles for some folks with some
stupid. Dr. Rogers.
Okay, just 1 second. From some stupid mess like that. So a lot of the damage is internal in our own community. And so the agenda planning has got to start with us, you know. And so the environment that we're assessing, I know you got your Trumps, you got your alt-right, you got all of them. They're doing their dirt. But now we got a lot of other stuff going with it as well. Brother Griffin, you have a thought?
Yeah, Dr. Rogers, actually, you're hitting on the same things I keep trying to bring up with people. I saw an article with your boy Magic Johnson talking about how he helped to turn Harlem around.
Okay.
And his idea of turning Harlem around is he brought in some Starbucks and some AMC theaters out in Watts, and he got another major chain to come into Harlem. Uh-huh. How in the world is that helping just what I said to you before?
Right.
Earlier, to be the face of gentrification and become a part of the very system that's preying on us. What difference does it make if the foot in the boot is black? You're not doing anything to uplift the community.
No, you're not.
You're just taking a white man's place, and you're telling me you're making $1 million, but he's making $10 million off of you being the face of his business. How is that helping the community?
Very clearly, you're right. He tried to do that in Milwaukee as well. He did. He did open up a Starbucks in Milwaukee, and then he wanted to bring a movie complex into this big mall. But the problem with the mall is that, you know, you got youth gangs, and those youth gangs would always attack that, you know?
Yes, yes.
And those youth
now, gangs, the other thing I want to say to you is I know you're familiar with Brother Ajuma Baraka that ran in the Green Party as a vice president.
Right.
Nominee.
Right.
He's got Black Alliance for Peace.
Uh-huh.
I interact with him sometimes. I don't know him personally or anything. But when Brother Marcus keeps talking about going to Africa, I've said this before on your program, and I'm going to tell you, I don't just say it because I think it's an idea. All right. of what Brother Marcus says sounds good, except for one thing. When I tell you again, we got to worry about what we got to do today to make sure there's a future.
Right.
If you want to be able to go to Africa, the best thing you can do is to start advocating to get AFRICOM and the NGOs off the damn continent.
Right.
Because they're already there.
Right.
The guy that died in Niger, he's there. And his, I'm in a place where a lot of military people are.
Okay.
And they'll tell you things off the record.
Right.
Part of what the military is doing is what couldn't be done with the NGOs. They are literally GPS mapping that continent for the accurate location of resources,
right.
Satellite coverage and everything. That's what our military people are doing. The contingent, there's military people connected to 52 out of 54 countries on the African continent.
Right.
They are strategically mapping out. And here's my point. When people keep saying, go back to Africa, Zambia is finding out right now that they thought they had a better friend in the Chinese by letting them come in and build roads
right,
and build
right,
airports,
right.
And then everything is fine. They're just supposed to be taking some money for operating. Mm-hmm. But guess what ends up happening? You're in your own country and you don't own anything.
No.
What difference does it make is if you're getting $500,000 or $500 million a year on something that they're walking away with $1 trillion clear, right. And they own the infrastructure and everything.
That's right.
You can't. Our people are too short-sighted to understand. It's better to remain in poverty and come up on your own, owning your own property, than it is to sell out for a quick show of a few thousand dollars.
Right.
That's right. That's right. I think your brother, Marcus, you were saying something.
Yes. And those people are there because we ain't there.
Right.
Look, Brother Marcus, to be honest with you.
Because we ain't there, brother. We should be there.
I won't talk over you. I'm just going to try to direct you to this. Do we have the trillions of dollars it takes to go in and build that airport and then turn it over to our people? We're talking about the scale and the magnitude of what it takes to have investments. That's the kind of reparations we should be looking for, to be able to dictate how a loan goes to somebody in that country, and it's our black people that are the ones that are monitoring the project and making the money off of writing the bonds and stuff. But that's not what our people are asking for. Our people are asking for strip club money.
Let me ask you a question, my brother.
Okay.
What is the prize? Is Africa the prize, or is America the prize for black people? Brother Griffin, is Africa the prize for black people, or is America the prize for black people?
See, you're asking me a disingenuous question. Africa? The price is survival, no matter where we are on the planet.
Well, you're not going to survive.
Okay, then. Don't even try to go there. I just asked you a legitimate question based on the propositions that I've been listening to you say, and they sound good. Do we have the economic
wherewithal
to be able to finance those
things? We do. The resources are in the ground in Africa. That's it.
So,
just like all the European go to Africa and get those resources and
You're still being disingenuous, because here's what I'm going to say to you again. I've done business here in America, and I'm going to tell you this. No matter how much money you have, you can't buy what somebody's not willing to sell, and you can't sell what somebody's not willing to buy. Hold on, I'm gonna tell you again. If those countries could go to the World Bank and get that money and build their own airports, they would probably do it if they didn't have corrupt people leading them. Those people signing away the public wealth of their country for immediate gratification. I'm not going to argue with you about theoretically where the prize is. I'm telling you what the actual problem is.
Brother, the leadership does that in Africa. We know that. But we're not going there to align ourselves with the leadership. We're going there to align ourselves with the people, with the grassroots people. They are the ones standing on the wealth. They are the ones who man the army. It's the people. It's not those politicians. And the people, they're fed up with them too now. You see? So that's who we should align ourselves with, is the mass majority of our people on the continent. Because that is where our survival lies. It is evident that we're not surviving here in this country.
No.
We are at the mercy of these people in this country. We are in, we are in prison here.
Right.
And so the salvation is there. It's the motherland. But we refuse to align ourselves with them. We want to align ourselves here in America with these people who don't have no intention of aligning themselves with us.
Right, and you're going to have to deal with Africa, and you're going to have to deal with them strategically, because nobody else. You're not going to be able to go to the Saudi Arabians and do anything with them.
Exactly.
They're not going to. And obviously the Chinese aren't either. It has to be Africa. And we're going
We understand that everybody not going to go to Africa.
Right.
We know that. But it's Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad.
Right.
See, so I go to Africa, Brother Griffin. I send you something, are you saying me something? Okay, that's right. The talk. We right. Don't want to go, no problem. We still do business together. We still trade together. I make sure you have some money in your pocket. You make sure I have some resources, some tools to do what I got to do in the motherland. Mm-hmm. That's the solution, my brother. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So after that, everybody getting wealthy in Africa. Everybody in Africa getting rich. And we here sitting down wondering, what we should do. Okay. Come on, my brother, we got to wake up. We got to reclaim. Reclaiming your mind is also reclaiming our legacy. That is our legacy. Africa.
Okay.
That is our natural legacy. It's not this. They haven't even scratched the surface.
Really?
They haven't even scratched the surface. So, anyway, good brother, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And also, another area that obviously, if we are talking about looking at some of these, a country like Africa and going over there to work with them. I remember when the Africans were wanting to, most of them had began to get their independence, and they were going to the World Bank and to the IMF, getting monies to buy equipment so they could dig into the ground. And then the problem was that a lot of them did not have the skills to operate that equipment. A lot of the stuff was sitting idle. And then they had to bring in these outside forces who came in, and like Brother Griffin said, they took most of the money. Because the other part of it is that you're going to have to also be able to protect whatever you're doing. Because now you've got the military stuff. If you go work in the Sudan, you've got rebel groups in the Sudan that will fight you. The Janui were very clearly attacking everybody. They did not attack the Chinese because the Chinese obviously have the powerful military.
They bought them off. That's my point, Dr. Rogers. When I say to him, I'm not trying to argue with Brother Marcus. What I'm telling him is before I started running my mouth about this and I listened to the people, I started doing the same thing you did with the garden, what is the Guardian and the other paper from
right,
the island.
Right, exactly.
I started reading what the people on the ground are saying.
That's what you
when you have leaders that will become billionaires rather than do exactly what you were saying, they could have easily had that equipment, bought that equipment with government money.
Right.
They could have easily recruited black people from this continent to help it, but that wasn't going to make them billionaires.
Exactly.
Nigeria has the very same problem. Nigeria has more billionaires than any country other than the United States. And guess what?
Mm-hmm.
They also went from having 60 million people in poverty to having about 85 million 10 years later. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
That the leaders are doing the very same thing the wealthy people are doing here.
Yeah.
I can't go for that. You can do it in Africa.
Right.
You have to understand how world markets work. This country right now has Venezuela and Cuba in economic solitude to keep them from being able to prosper.
Exactly.
We got to start dealing with reality, not a pie-in-the-sky dream.
Yeah. And that's going to require education, and that's going to
Part of it is what I'm saying. If you really want to help Africa, demand that we get our military off of the continent.
Right, right. That's right. And very clearly, our children have to understand this whole concept and analysis. We've got to begin to teach them. Because then if not, all we're going to be is talking heads and we just keep going back and forward. They've got to be made to understand that. That comes through education system and getting some kind of a mechanism in place to train them about the analogy of that and how it works.
True. I served in the military, and I tell people now, I get upset with them, even people I know in real life and the people I know in the virtual world. When they tell me their daughter's about to go in the military. It's like, oh, hold on. If you understand imperialism, why would you want to add your child to that fight?
Yeah.
They're not doing anything for you.
No, they're not. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end. We've got about 5 minutes left. This has been an excellent discussion. I thank Brother Marcus and I thank Brother Griffin for their contribution to this discussion. We've got work to do, brothers and sisters, as you know. We've got to learn where we come from and what we're doing and where we are and understanding our environment and act upon that in a constructive way as opposed to being onlookers. We're still spending too much time as onlookers. We got people that are killing our children. We have to stop that. We've got to find a way to do that. We can't deny it. We're dying of poor health. We've got businesses coming in our community and feeding us garbage. And we are participating in it. So we've got to come with an agenda structure based on a clear understanding of what is happening to you. And as we talked about on Brother Elliott's program on Sunday, what would you do first? We've got to get the healthy condition of our children in place first. Our children are not healthy, and they have to be made to be healthy so they can have longevity and build some structures. And I'm not sure that there is not a way sometimes that we can look, you know, outside of the African borders in terms of building. I don't think everybody has to go there. But there are some things that we can look at that could be done, but it has to be done logistically and carefully. And that's what we were trying to say tonight, folks. A lot of stuff was coming at us in the news. A lot of it's false, builds up false hope, continuously contributes to our trauma and our stress, which that alone is killing us. And so what we have to do is we have to begin, as I said, first of all, to understand our environment and understand how we're going to best navigate it for our future. And that is going to be the ongoing fight and struggle. And so I will continue to do that from the position that I have until my days on this planet are finished. But that's the commitment. That is the commitment. Next week, we hope to bring, we've got Brother Bill Doggett, who's going to be coming on. He won't come next week. We're looking to try to bring him on the next week. He has a topic. We've been looking at some of the museum work and the archiving of our history so that our children will understand where we've come from. So we'll be looking to have him on very shortly, in the next week or so. So anyway, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that you have a good week coming up, and I look forward to seeing you on next Tuesday at 8 right here on timeforanawakening.com. We thank you.
Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is
black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free, black is us, black is